This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs, written by Johan Hari, performed by Tim Reynolds.
Introduction. Almost 100 years after the start of the War on Drugs, I found myself stuck on one of its more minor battlefields. In the suburbs of North London, one of my closest relatives had been rock-bottoming on cocaine again, while my ex-boyfriend was ending his long East London romance with heroin and picking up a crack pipe instead. I was watching all this with some distance, in part because I had been swallowing fistfuls of fat white narcolepsy pills for years. I am not narcoleptic. Many years before, I had read that if you take them, you can write in long manic weeks without pause and without rest. And it worked. I was wired. All this felt like home to me. One of my earliest memories is of trying to wake one of my relatives from a drugged slump and not being able to. Ever since, I've been oddly drawn to addicts and recovering addicts. They feel like my tribe, my group, my people. But now, for the first time, I was beginning to wonder if I had become an addict myself. My long, drugged writing binges would stop only when I collapsed with exhaustion, and I wouldn't be able to wake for days. I realized one morning that I must have been starting to look a little like the relative I had been trying to wake up all those years before. I had been taught how to respond, by my government and by my culture, when you find yourself in this situation. It is with a war. We all know the script. It's etched onto your subconscious, like the correct direction to look when you cross the street. Treat drug users and addicts as criminals. Repress them, shame them, coerce them into stopping. This is the prevailing view in almost every country in the world. For years, I had been publicly arguing against this strategy. I wrote newspaper articles and appeared on television to argue that punishing and shaming drug users only makes them worse and creates a blizzard of other problems for the society. I argued instead for a second strategy. Legalize drugs stage by stage and use the money we currently spend on punishing addicts to fund compassionate care instead. But as I stared at these people I loved through my own drugged glaze, a small part of me wondered if I really meant what I'd been saying. The voices in my mind were like a howling drill sergeant in an old Vietnam War movie shrieking abuse at the recruits. You are an idiot to do this. This is shameful. You are a fool for not stopping. Somebody should prevent you. You should be punished. So, even as I criticized the war with my words, I was often waging it in my head. I can't say I was evenly divided. My rational mind always favored reform, but this internal conflict wouldn't stop. I'd been looking for a way out of this chemical-stained stalemate for years. And then, one morning, a thought came to me. You and the people you love are just tiny smudges on a much larger canvas. If you stay where you are, focused only on the shape of your own little smudges, this year, like last year and the year before, you will never understand more than you do now. But what if you found a way to step back and look, for once, at the entire painting? I scribbled down some questions that had puzzled me for years. Why did the drug war start? And why does it continue? Why can some people use drugs without any problems, while others can't? What really causes addiction? What happens if you choose a radically different policy? I decided to go on a journey across the front lines of the war on drugs to find the answers. So I packed up my apartment, flushed my last remaining pills down the toilet, and set off. I knew this war had begun in the United States, although at that point I didn't know when or how. I arrived in New York City with a list of names of experts in this field. It's a good thing, I know now, that I didn't book a return ticket. I didn't realize it on that first day, but this journey would end up taking me across 9 countries and 30,000 miles, and it would last for 3 years. On the road, I found the stories of people I could not have imagined at the start, people who taught me the answers to the questions I'd been wrestling with for so long. A transsexual crack dealer in Brooklyn who wanted to know who killed his mother. A nurse in Ciudad Juarez, marching through the desert searching for her daughter. A child smuggled out of the Budapest ghetto during the Holocaust, who grew up to uncover the real causes of addiction. A junkie leading an uprising in Vancouver. A serial killer in a cage in Texas. A Portuguese doctor who led his country to decriminalize all drugs from cannabis to crack. A scientist in Los Angeles who had been feeding hallucinogens to a mongoose just to see what would happen. They, and many others, were my teachers. I was startled by what I learned from them. It turns out that many of our most basic assumptions about this subject are wrong. Drugs are not what we think they are. Drug addiction is not what we have been told it is. The drug war is not what our politicians have sold it as for 100 years and counting. And there is a very different story out there waiting for us when we are ready to hear it. One that should leave us thrumming with hope. Part 1. Mount Rushmore. Chapter 1. The Black Hand. As I waited in the drowsy, neon-lit customs line at JFK, I tried to remember precisely when the war on drugs started. In some vague way, I had a sense that it must have been with Richard Nixon in the 1970s, when the phrase was first widely used. Or was it with Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, when Just Say No seemed to become the second national anthem? But when I started to travel around New York City, interviewing experts on drug policy, I began to get a sense that this whole story had, in fact, begun long before. The pledge to wage relentless warfare on drugs was, I found, first made in the 1930s, by a man who has been largely forgotten today. Yet he did more than any other individual to create the drug world we now live in. I learned there are vast, forgotten piles of this man's paperwork at Penn State University, his diary, his letters, all his files. So I headed there on a Greyhound bus and began to read through everything I could find by and about Harry Anslinger. Only then did I begin to see who he really was and what he means for us all. In those files, I learned that at the birth of the war on drugs, there were 3 people who could be seen as its founding figures. If there was a Mount Rushmore for drug prohibition, it is their faces who would be carved into its mountainside, staring impassively back, slowly eroding. I chased the information about them across many more archives, and to the last remaining people who remember them. Now, 3 years later, after all I have learned, I find myself picturing these founding figures as they were when the drug war clouds first began to gather. As kids, scattered across the United States, not knowing what was about to hit them or what they would achieve. That is where, it seems to me, this story begins. In 1904, a 12-year-old boy was visiting his neighbor's farmhouse in the cornfields of western Pennsylvania when he heard a scream. It was coming from somewhere above him. This sound, desperate, aching, made him confused. What was going on? Why would a grown woman howl like an animal? Her husband ran down the stairs and gave the boy a set of hurried instructions. Take my horse and cart into the town as fast as you can. Pick up a package from the pharmacy. Bring it here. Do it now. The boy lashed at the horses because he was certain that if he failed, he would return to find a corpse. As soon as he flopped through the door and handed over the bag of drugs, the farmer ran to his wife. Her screaming stopped, and she was calm. But the boy would not be calm about this. Not ever again. "I never forgot those screams," he wrote years later. From that moment on, he was convinced there was a group of people walking among us who may look and sound normal, but who could at any moment become emotionally hysterical, degenerate, mentally deficient, and vicious, if they were allowed contact with the great unhinging agent, drugs. When he grew into a man, this boy was going to draw together some of the deepest fears in American culture, of racial minorities, of intoxication, of losing control, and channel them into a global war to prevent those screams. It would cause many screams in turn. They can be heard in almost every city on Earth tonight. This is how Harry Anslinger entered the drug war. On a different afternoon, a few years earlier, on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, a wealthy Orthodox Jewish trader walked in on a scene that he could not understand. His 3-year-old son was standing over his sleeping brother, holding a knife, ready to stab him. "Why, my son, why?" the trader asked. The little boy said that he hated his brother. The boy was going to hate a lot of people in his life. Almost everyone, in fact. He would later declare that "the majority of the human race are dubs and dumbbells and have rotten judgment and no brains." He would plunge his knife into many people as soon as he had gained enough wealth and power to get other people to wield the weapon. Normally, a man with his personality type would end up in prison, but this little boy didn't. He was handed an industry where his capacity for violence was not just rewarded, but required. The new market for illegal drugs in North America. When he was finally shot, separated by 20 blocks, countless killings, and many millions of dollars from his sleeping brother on that night, he was a free man. This is how Arnold Rothstein entered the drug war. On yet another afternoon in 1920, a 6-year-old girl lay on the floor of a brothel in Baltimore, listening to jazz records. Her mother was convinced this music was the work of Satan and wouldn't let her hear a note of it at home. So the child offered to perform small cleaning tasks for the madam of the local whorehouse on one condition. Instead of being paid a nickel, like the other kids, she would take her pay on this floor, in rapt hours left alone to listen. It gave her a feeling she couldn't describe, and she was determined one day to create this feeling in other people. Even after she was raped, and after she was pimped, and after she started to inject heroin to take away the pain, this music would still be there, waiting for her. This is how Billie Holiday entered the drug war. When Harry and Arnold and Billie were born, drugs were freely available throughout the world. You could go into any American pharmacy and buy products made from the same ingredients as heroin and cocaine. The most popular cough mixtures in the United States contained opiates. A new soft drink, called Coca-Cola, was made from the same plant as snortable cocaine. And over in Britain, the classiest department stores sold heroin tins for society women. But they lived at a time when American culture was looking for an outlet for its swelling tide of anxiety, a real physical object it could destroy, in the hope that this would destroy its fear of a world that was changing more rapidly than their parents and grandparents could ever have imagined. It settled on these chemicals. In 1914, a century ago, they resolved, destroy them. Wipe them from the earth. Set yourself free. As this decision was made, Harry and Arnold and Billy found themselves scattered across that first battlefield and pressed into combat. When Billie Holiday stood on stage, her hair was pulled back tightly, her face was round and shining in the lights, and her voice was scratched with pain. It was on one of these nights, in 1939, that she started to sing a song that would become iconic. Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the root. Before, black women had, with very few exceptions, been allowed on stage only as beaming caricatures, stripped of all real feeling. But now, here, she was Lady Day, a black woman expressing grief and fury at the mass murder of her brothers in the South, their battered bodies hanging from the trees. It was extremely brave, when you think about it. Her goddaughter, Lorraine Feather, told me. At that time, every song was about love. You simply did not have a piece of music being performed at some hotel that was about the killing of people, about such a sordid and cruel fact. It was not done, ever. And to have an African-American woman doing such a song, about lynching. But Billy did it because the song seemed to spell out all the things that had killed her father, Clarence, in the South. The audience listened, hushed. Many years later, this moment would be called the beginning of the civil rights movement. Lady Day was ordered by the authorities to stop singing this song. She refused. Her harassment by Harry's Federal Bureau of Narcotics began the next day. Before long, he would play a crucial role in killing her. From his first day in office, Harry Anslinger had a problem, and everybody knew it. He had just been appointed head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, a tiny agency buried in the grey bowels of the Treasury Department in Washington, D.C., and it seemed to be on the brink of being abolished. This was the old Department of Prohibition, but Prohibition had been abolished, and his men needed a new role, fast. As he looked over his new staff, just a few years before his pursuit of Billy began, he saw a sunken army who had spent 14 years waging war on alcohol, only to see alcohol win, and win big. These men were notoriously corrupt and crooked, but now Harry was supposed to whip them into a force capable of wiping drugs from the United States forever. And that was only the first obstacle. Many drugs, including marijuana, were still legal, and the Supreme Court had recently ruled that people addicted to harder drugs should be dealt with by doctors, not bang-em-up men like Harry. And then, almost before he had settled into his office chair, Harry's budget was slashed by $70,000. What was the point of this department, this position, this work? It seemed his new kingdom of drug prohibition would crumble into bureaucratic history at any moment. Within a few years, the stress of trying to hold this together and creating a role for himself would make all of Harry's hair fall out and leave him looking, according to his staff, like a wrestler printed in primary colours on a fading poster. Harry believed that the response to being dealt a weak hand should always be to dramatically raise the stakes. He pledged to eradicate all drugs, everywhere, and within 30 years he succeeded in turning this crumbling department, with these disheartened men, into the headquarters for a global war that would last for 100 years and counting. He could do it because he was a bureaucratic genius, and, even more crucially, because there was a deep strain in American culture that was waiting for a man like him, with a sure and certain answer to their questions about chemicals. Ever since that day in his neighbor's farmhouse, Harry had known that he wanted to lead the charge to wipe drugs from the earth, but nobody imagined that, from where he started, he could ever do it, never mind so quickly. His dad was a Swiss hairdresser who had fled his home in the mountains to avoid military conscription, and eventually washed up in Pennsylvania, where he had 9 kids. He couldn't afford much schooling for them, so when the 8th child, Harry, was 14, he was forced to go out to work on the railroad. He was a determined boy, and he insisted on working for money in the afternoons and evenings, so he could keep going to school every morning. but it was in his paid work that Harry got his greatest education. There, laying the train tracks for the state of Pennsylvania, he got his first glimpse of something dark and hidden, and it would become his second lifelong obsession. It was his task to supervise a large number of recent Sicilian immigrants. "Sometimes," he wrote, "he heard them talking darkly in hushed asides about something called a black hand." Harry recorded their thoughts in the style of the pulp fiction thrillers he was obsessed with. You didn't mention it in front of strangers. You didn't mention it even in front of your family unless you had to. But it could destroy you with one swipe. What could this black hand be? Nobody would tell. But one morning, Harry found one of his work crew, an Italian man named Giovanni, bleeding in a ditch. He had been shot multiple times. When Giovanni woke up in the hospital, Harry was there, ready to hear what had happened. But the workman was too terrified to speak. Anslinger spent hours assuring him that he could keep him and his family safe. Finally, Giovanni spoke. He said he was being forced to pay protection money by a man called Big Mouth Sam, one of the thugs belonging to a group called the Mafia. That had come to the United States from Sicily and remained hidden amidst the Italian immigrants. The Mafia, Giovanni told Harry, were engaged in all sorts of crimes, and people on the railroad were being charged a terror tax. You gave the Mafia money, or else you ended up in a hospital bed like this. Or worse. Anslinger went to confront Big Mouth Sam, a squat, black-haired and ox-shouldered immigrant, and said, "If Giovanni dies, I'm going to see to it that you hang. Do you understand that?" Big Mouth tried to reply, but Harry insisted, "And if he lives, and you ever bother him again, or any of my men, or try to shake any of them down any more, I'll kill you with my own hands." After that, Anslinger became obsessed with the Mafia, at a time when most Americans refused to believe it even existed. This is hard for us to understand today, but the official position of every official in the U.S. law enforcement until the 1960s, from J. Edgar Hoover on down, was that the Mafia was a preposterous conspiracy theory, no more real than the Loch Ness Monster. They reacted the same way we would now if a law enforcement agent preached trutherism or birtherism, or the belief that Freemasons are secretly manipulating world events, with bafflement at the idea that anyone could believe something so silly. But Harry had glimpsed the Mafia in the flesh, and he was convinced that if he followed the trail from Big Mouth Sam to the thugs above him and the thugs above them, he would be led to a vast global web, and perhaps even to an invisible worldwide government, secretly controlling events. He soon started keeping every scrap of information he could find on the Mafia, no matter how small or how trivial the source. He snipped small stories from pulp magazines and stored them away. One day, he thought, he would use this information. As soon as the First World War started, Harry began to sign up for the military, but he was blind in one eye. His brother had hit him with a rock years before, and was turned down. But since he spoke fluent German, he was offered a position as a diplomatic agent in Europe. And before long, he was travelling on a boat to London, through a fog that had left the British Isles invisible and lost. From there, he travelled on to Hamburg and The Hague, where his job was to ferret out information on local diplomats and to deal with local Americans in trouble. Several discharged American sailors were brought to him to be shipped home because they'd become addicted to heroin. Harry stared into their skeletal faces and found that the hatred he felt as a small boy was only swelling. This, he promised himself, would be stopped. At the very end of the war, as it was becoming clear to everyone that the Germans had lost, Harry was sent on his most important mission so far, to take a secret message to the defeated German dictator. The way he later told the story, Harry was dispatched to a small Dutch town of Amerongen, where the Kaiser was holed up in a castle and planning to abdicate. Anslinger's job was to pose as a German official and convey a message from President Woodrow Wilson. Don't do it. The United States wanted the Kaiser to retain the imperial throne, to prevent the rise of the revolution, strikes, and chaos it feared would follow from his sudden departure. The Dutch guards at the gates of the castle ordered Harry to show his credentials. "Show me your credentials," he snapped back in his fiercest German. Frightened, assuming he was one of the Kaiser's men, they let him through. Harry managed to get the message through, but it was too late. The decision had been made. The Kaiser quit. For the rest of his life, Anslinger believed that if he had gotten the president's plea through only a little earlier, a decent piece might have been written, forestalling any chance for a future Hitler gaining power, or a Second World War erupting. It was the first time Harry felt that the future of civilization hung on his actions. But it would not be the last. He travelled across a Europe in rubble. "The sight of a large city in ruins, without a house seen standing, creates a feeling that is hard to describe," he wrote in his diary. "All bridges down. Factories either blown up entirely, or all machinery removed, or machinery dumped along the way in broken, twisted, and damaged condition. Utterly useless. Magnify the imagination by 20 times. Great shell holes, barbed wire by the acres." But what shook Harry most was the effect of the war not on the buildings, but on the people. They seemed to have lost all sense of order. Starving, they'd begun to riot. The cavalry had been sent to charge against them, and entire streets were on fire. Harry was standing in the hotel lobby in Berlin when socialist revolutionaries suddenly fired their machine guns into the lobby and blood from a bystander splattered onto his hands. Civilization, he was beginning to conclude, was as fragile as the personality of that farmer's wife back in Altoona. It could break. After this, and for the rest of his life, Harry retained a deep sense that American society could collapse into wreckage just as quickly as Europe's had. In 1926, he was redeployed from the grey wreckage of Europe to the blue-watered islands of the Bahamas. But Harry was not a man looking for a reason to relax. This was the height of alcohol prohibition. Americans wanted to drink, and smugglers wanted to sell to them. So whiskey was washing through these islands like water. Harry was outraged. The bootleggers were West Indian and Central American, and he believed they were filled with loathsome and contagious diseases that would spread to anyone foolish enough to drink the booze they handled. "Just give me a high-powered rifle. I'll stop the bastards," one of Harry's colleagues said. And in this spirit, Harry announced to his bosses that there was a way to make prohibition work. Use maximum force. Send the Navy to hunt down smugglers along the coasts of America. Ban the sale of alcohol for medical purposes. Massively increase prison sentences for alcohol dealers until they were all locked up. Wage war on booze until it was only a memory. In just a few years, Harry made the leap from being a competent, if frustrated, prohibition agent in the Bahamas to running a Washington, D.C. department. How did he do it? It's hard to tell, but it must have helped that he married a young woman named Martha Denniston, who was from one of the richest families in America, the Mellons. The Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon, was now a close relative, and the Prohibition Department was part of the Treasury itself. From the moment he took charge of the Bureau, Harry was aware of the weakness of his new position. A war on narcotics alone, cocaine and heroin, outlawed in 1914, wasn't enough. They were used only by a tiny minority, and you couldn't keep an entire department alive on such small crumbs. He needed more. With this in mind, he'd begun noticing stories in the newspapers that intrigued him. They had headlines like the one from the July 6th, 1927 edition of the New York Times, "Mexican Family Go Insane." It explained, "A widow and her four children have been driven insane by eating the marijuana plant, according to doctors who say there is no hope of saving the children's lives, and that the mother will be insane for the rest of her life." The mother had no money to buy food, so she decided to eat some marijuana plants that had been growing in their garden. Soon after, "Neighbors, hearing outbursts of crazed laughter, rushed to the house to find the entire family insane." Harry had long dismissed cannabis as a nuisance that would only distract him from the drugs he really wanted to fight. He insisted it was not addictive, and stated, "There is probably no more absurd fallacy than the claim that it caused violent crime." But almost overnight, he began to argue the opposite position. Why? He believed the two most feared groups in the United States, Mexican immigrants and African Americans, were taking the drug much more than white people, and he presented the House Committee on Appropriations with a nightmarish vision of where this could lead. He had been told, he said, of colored students at the University of Minnesota partying with female students, white, and getting their sympathy with stories of racial persecution. Result? Pregnancy. This was the first hint of much more to come. He wrote to 30 scientific experts, asking a series of questions about marijuana. 29 of them wrote back saying it would be wrong to ban it, and that it was being widely misrepresented in the press. Anslinger decided to ignore them, and quoted instead the one expert who believed it was a great evil that had to be eradicated. On this basis, Harry warned the public about what happens when you smoke this weed. First, you will fall into a delirious rage. Then you will be gripped by dreams of an erotic character. Then you will lose the power of connected thought. Finally, you will reach the inevitable end point. Insanity. You could easily get stoned and go out and kill a person, and it would all be over before you even realized you had left your room, he said, because marijuana turns man into a wild beast. Indeed. If the hideous monster Frankenstein came face to face with the monster marijuana, he would drop dead of fright. A doctor called Michael V. Ball got in touch with Harry to counter this view, saying he had used hemp extract as a medical student and it only made him sleepy. He suspected that the claims circulating about the drug couldn't possibly be true. Maybe, he said, cannabis does drive people crazy in a tiny number of cases, but his hunch was that anybody reacting that way probably had an underlying mental health problem already. He implored Anslinger to fund proper lab studies so they could find out the truth. Anslinger wrote back firmly, "The marijuana evil can no longer be temporized with," he explained, and he would fund no independent science, then or ever. For years, doctors kept approaching him with evidence that he was wrong, and he began to snap, telling them they were treading on dangerous ground and should watch their mouths. Instead, he wrote to police officers across the country, commanding them to find him cases where marijuana had caused people to kill, and the stories started to roll in. The defining case for Harry, and for America, was of a young man named Victor Licata. He was a 21-year-old Florida boy, known in his neighborhood as a sane, rather quiet young man, until, the story went, the day he smoked cannabis. He then entered a marijuana dream in which he believed he was being attacked by men who would cut off his arms. So he struck back, seizing an axe and hacking his mother, father, two brothers, and sister to pieces. The press, at Harry's prompting, made Licata's story famous. "If your son smoked marijuana," people came to believe, "he, too, could hack you to pieces." Anslinger was not the originator of these arguments, They had actually been widespread in Mexico in the late 19th century, where it was pervasively believed that marijuana made you loco. Nor was he the only one pushing them in the United States. The press loved these stories, especially the mass media owned by William Randolph Hearst. But for the first time, Anslinger gave them the backing of a government department that would broadcast them to the nation at full volume with an official government stamp saying they were true. From the clouds of cannabis smoke, he warned, there were Victor Licatas rising all around us. The warnings worked. People began to clamour for the Bureau of Narcotics to be given more money to save them from this terrifying threat. Harry's problem, the fragility of his new empire, was starting to ease. Many years later, the law professor John Kaplan went back to look into the medical files for Victor Licata. The psychiatrists who examined him said he had long suffered from acute and chronic insanity. His family was full of people who suffered from similarly extreme mental health problems. Three had been committed to insane asylums, and the local police had tried for a year before the killings to get Licata committed to a mental hospital, but his parents insisted they wanted to look after him at home. The examining psychiatrists thought his cannabis use was so irrelevant that it wasn't even mentioned in his files. But Anslinger had his story now. He announced on a famous radio address, "Parents, beware! Your children are being introduced to a new danger in the form of a drugged cigarette, marijuana. Young people are slaves to this narcotic continuing addiction until they deteriorate mentally, become insane, and turn to violent crime and murder." Harry was sticking to his story, whatever he was told, in part because, while he was asserting against a wall of skepticism that marijuana drove you mad, he was discovering something incredible. Everybody had mocked him when he said the mafia existed. "Where's your evidence?" they asked witheringly. But now, through his agents, Anslinger was uncovering proof that the mafia not only existed, but was bigger than anyone had imagined. He was building up a scrapbook containing the names of details of 800 mafiosi operating in the continental United States. His raids were proving him right, but the authorities still refused to believe him, preferring to look away, awkwardly. Some were corrupt. Some simply didn't want to disturb their 100% cleanup records by taking on such a difficult and messy crusade, and some were frightened. When the police chief of New Orleans, David Hennessy, started to dig too deeply into the mafia, he was murdered. Anslinger began to believe all his hunches would turn out like this. He only had to defy the experts and keep pursuing his instinct until finally he would be shown to be more right than anyone could have predicted. He ramped up his campaign. The most frightening effect of marijuana, Harry warned, was on blacks. It made them forget the appropriate racial barriers and unleashed their lust for white women. Of course, everyone spoke about race differently in the 1930s, but the intensity of Harry's views shocked people even then, and when it was revealed he'd referred to a suspect in an official memo as a nigger, Senator Joseph P. Guffey of Anslinger's home state of Pennsylvania demanded his resignation. Later, when one of his very few black agents, William B. Davis, complained about being called a nigger by Harry's men, Anslinger sacked him. Harry soon started treating all his critics this way. When the American Medical Association issued a report debunking some of his more overheated claims, he announced that any of his agents caught with a copy would be immediately fired. Then, when he found out a professor named Alfred Lindesmith was arguing that addicts needed to be treated with compassion and care, Harry instructed his men to falsely warn Lindesmith's university that he was associated with a criminal organization, had him wiretapped, and sent a team to tell him to shut up. Harry couldn't control the flow of drugs, but he was discovering he could control the flow of ideas. And it was not only scientists, Harry believed, he had to silence. It was clear, from Harry's writings, that he was obsessed with Billie Holiday, and I sensed there might be a deeper story there. So I tracked down everyone who was still alive who had known Billie to ask them about this. And one of them, her godson, Bevan Dufty, explained that his mother had been Billie's best friend, and she believed Billie was in effect killed by the authorities. He had her writings on this in his attic, where they had been unseen for years. He asked if I would like to see them. Jazz was the opposite of everything Harry Anslinger believed in. It is improvised and relaxed and free form. It follows its own rhythm. Worst of all, it is a mongrel music made up of European, Caribbean, and African echoes, all mating on American shores. To Anslinger, this was musical anarchy, and evidence of a reoccurrence of the primitive impulse that lurk in black people, waiting to emerge. "It sounded," his internal memo said, "like the jungles in the dead of night." Another memo warned that unbelievably ancient, indecent rites of the East Indians are resurrected in this black man's music. The lives of the jazzmen, he said, reek of filth. His agents reported back to him that many among the jazzmen think they are playing magnificently when under the influence of marijuana, but they are actually becoming hopelessly confused and playing horribly. The Bureau believed that marijuana slowed down your perception of time dramatically, and this was why jazz music sounded so freakish. The musicians were literally living at a different, inhuman rhythm. "Music hath charms," their memos say, "but not this music." Indeed, Harry took jazz as yet more proof that marijuana drives people insane. For example, the song That Funny Reefer Man contains the line, "Anytime he gets a notion, he can walk across the ocean." Harry's agents warned, "He does think that." Anslinger looked out over a scene filled with men like Charlie Parker, Louis Armstrong, and Thelonious Monk. And, as the journalist Larry Sloman recorded, he longed to see them all behind bars. He wrote to all the agents he had sent to follow them, and instructed, "Please prepare all cases in your jurisdiction involving musicians in violation of the marijuana laws. We will have a great national roundup arrest of all such persons on a single day. I will let you know what day." His advice on drug raids to his men was always, "Shoot first." He reassured congressmen that this crackdown would affect not the good musicians, but the jazz type. But when Harry came for them, the jazz world would have one weapon that saved them. Its absolute solidarity. Anslinger's men could find almost no one among them who was willing to snitch, and whenever one of them was busted, they all chipped in to bail him out. In the end, the Treasury Department told Anslinger he was wasting his time taking on a community that couldn't be fractured, so he scaled down his focus until it settled like a laser on a single target. Perhaps the greatest female jazz vocalist there ever was. Billie Holiday was born a few months after the Harrison Act, the first law banning cocaine and heroin, and it would become her lifelong twin. Not long after Billie's birth, her 19-year-old mother, Sadie, became a prostitute, while her 17-year-old father vanished. He later died of pneumonia in the South because he couldn't find a hospital that would treat a black man. Billie brought herself up on the streets of Baltimore, alone, defiant. It was the last city without a sewer system in the United States, and she spent her childhood among clouds of stinking smoke from all the burning shit. Her cold slum district was known as Pigtown, and many people lived in shacks. Every day, little Billie would wash and clean her great-grandmother and listen to stories from her youth, when she had been a slave on a Virginia plantation. Billie soon learned there were lots of places she couldn't go because she was black. One store that sold hot dogs would let her in if nobody was looking, but gave her hell if she tried to eat inside, in case anybody saw. She knew in her gut this was wrong, and had to change, and she made a promise to herself. I just plain decided one day I wasn't going to do anything or say anything unless I meant it. Not please, sir, nor thank you, ma'am, nothing. Unless I meant it. You have to be poor and black to know how many times you can get knocked in the head for trying to do something as simple as that. This promise would reshape her life, and her attitude toward Harry. When she was 10, one of her neighbors, a man in his 40s named Wilbert Rich, turned up and explained that he had been sent by her mother to take Billy to her. He took her to a house and told her to wait. She sat and waited, but her mother didn't come. As night fell, Billy said she was drowsy. The man offered her a bed. When she lay down on it, he pinned her down and raped her. She screamed and clawed at the man, howling for help, and somebody must have heard because the police arrived. When they barged in, the officers decided at once what was going on. Billy, they declared, was a whore who had tricked this poor man. She was shut away in a cell for 2 days. Months later, Wilbert Rich was punished with 3 months in prison, while Billy was punished with a year in a reform school. The nuns who ran the walled-in, sealed-off punishment centre looked at the child and concluded she was bad and needed the firm thwack of discipline. Billy kept spitting their attempts at control right back at them, so they decided they needed to teach her a lesson. They took her to a room that was empty, except for a dead body, slammed the door shut behind her, and left her there overnight. Billy hammered on the doors until her hands bled, but nobody came. When she escaped, out of the convent and Baltimore, she was determined to find her mother, who was last heard from in Harlem. When she arrived on the bus into a freezing winter, she stumbled to the last address she had been given, only to find it was a brothel. Her mother worked there for a pittance, and had no way to keep her. Before long, Billy was thrown out, and she was so hungry she could barely breathe without it hurting. There was, Billy came to believe, only one solution. A madam offered her a 50% cut for having sex with strangers. She was 14 years old. Before long, Billy had her own pimp. He was a violent, cursing thug named Lewis McKay, who was going to break her ribs and beat her till she bled. He was also, perhaps more crucially, going to meet Harry Anslinger many years later and work with him. Within a few years, Billy's mother was telling her to marry Lewis. He was, she said, such a nice man. Billy was caught prostituting by the police, and once again, instead of rescuing her from being pimped and raped, they punished her. She was sent to prison on Welfare Island, and once she got out, she started to seek out the hardest and most head-blasting chemicals she could. At first, her favorite was White Lightning, a toxic brew containing 70-proof alcohol, and as she got older, she tried to stun her grief with harder and harder drugs. One night, a white boy from Dallas called Speck showed her how to inject herself with heroin. You just heat up the heroin in a spoon and inject it straight into your veins. When Billy wasn't drunk or high, she sank into a black rock of depression and was so shy she could barely speak. She would still wake in the night screaming, remembering her rape and imprisonment. "I got a habit, and I know it's no good," she told a friend, "but it's the only thing that makes me know there's a person called Billie Holiday. I am Billie Holiday." But then she discovered something else. One day, starving, she walked a dozen blocks in Harlem, asking in every drinking hole if they had any work for her, and she was rejected everywhere. Finally, she walked into a place called the Log Cabin and explained she could work as a dancer, but when she tried a few moves, it was obvious she wasn't good enough. Desperate, she told the owner maybe she could sing. He pointed her toward an old piano man in the corner and told her to give him a song. As she sang, "Travelin' All Alone," the customers put down their drinks and listened. By the time she finished her next song, "Body and Soul," there were tears running down their cheeks. She sang a moment behind the beat and lived a moment ahead of it. One New Year's Eve, a sailor saw her being served in a bar and asked, "When did you start serving nigger bitches?" She stabbed a bottle into his face. Another time, in another bar, a group of soldiers and sailors started stubbing out their cigarettes on her mink coat. She handed the mink coat to a friend to hold, picked up a diamond-shaped ashtray, and laid the sailors out flat. Yet, when it came to the men in her life, this impulse to defend herself bled away. Lewis McKay graduated from being her pimp to her manager and husband. He stole almost all her money. After her greatest performance at Carnegie Hall, he greeted her by punching her so hard in the face she was sent flying. Her story was about to crash into Harry Anslinger's. He had been, it turned out, watching her very carefully. Harry had heard whispers that this rising black star was using heroin, so he assigned an agent named Jimmy Fletcher to track her every move. Harry hated to hire black agents, but if he sent white guys into Harlem and Baltimore, they stood out straight away. Jimmy Fletcher was the answer. His job was to bust his own people. But Anslinger was insistent that no black man in his bureau could ever become a white man's boss. Jimmy was allowed through the door at the bureau, but never up the stairs. He was and would remain an archive man, a street agent whose job was to figure out who was selling, who was supplying, and who should be busted. He would carry large amounts of drugs with him, and he was allowed to deal drugs himself, so he could gain the confidence of the people he was secretly plotting to arrest. Many agents in this position would shoot heroin with their clients to prove they weren't cops. We don't know whether Jimmy joined in, but we do know that he had no pity for addicts. "I never knew a victim," he said. "You victimize yourself by becoming a junkie." He first saw Billy in her brother-in-law's apartment, where she was drinking enough booze to stun a horse and hoovering up vast quantities of cocaine. The next time he saw her, it was in a brothel in Harlem, doing exactly the same. Billy's greatest talent, after singing, was swearing. If she called you a motherfucker, it was a great compliment. We don't know the first time Billy called Jimmy a motherfucker, but she soon spotted this man who was hanging around her, watching her, and she grew to like him. When Jimmy was sent to raid her, he knocked at the door pretending he had a telegram to deliver. As her biographer, Julia Blackburn, records, Billy knew what that meant. "Stick it under the door," she yelled. "It's too big to go under the door," he snapped back. She let him in. She was alone. Jimmy felt uncomfortable. "Billy, why don't you make a short case of this, and if you've got anything, why don't you turn it over to us?" he asked. "Then we won't be searching around, pulling out your clothes and everything. So why don't you do that?" But Jimmy's partner arrived and sent for a policewoman to conduct a body search. "You don't have to do that. I'll strip," Billy said. "All I want to say is, will you search me and let me go? All that policewoman is going to do is look up my pussy." She stripped and stood there, and then she pissed in front of them, defying them to watch. When Billy sang, "Lover man, where can you be?" she wasn't crying for a man, she was crying for heroin. But when she found out her friends in the jazz world were using the same drug, she begged them to stop. "Never imitate me," she cried. "Never do this." She kept trying to quit. She would get her friends to shut her away in their houses for days on end while she went through withdrawal. As she ran back to her dealers, she cursed herself as No Guts Holiday. Why couldn't she stop? It's tough enough coming off when you've got somebody who loves you and trusts you and believes in you, she wrote. I didn't have anybody. Actually, she said, that's not quite right. She had Anslinger's agents. Betting their time, their shoe leather, and their money that they would get me. Nobody can live like that. The morning he first raided her, Jimmy took Billy to one side and promised to talk to Anslinger personally for her. I don't want you to lose your job, he said. Not long after, he ran into her in the bar, and they talked for hours with her pet chihuahua, Moochie, by her side. Then, one night, at Club Ebony, they ended up dancing together. Billie Holiday and Anslinger's agent, swaying together to the music. I had so many close conversations with her, about so many things. He would remember years later. She was the type who would make anyone sympathetic because she was the lovin' type. The man Anslinger sent to track and bust Billie Holiday had, it seems, fallen in love with her. Confronted with a real addict up close, the hatred fell away. But Anslinger was going to be given a break on Billy, one he got nowhere else in the jazz world. Billy had got used to turning up at gigs so badly beaten by Lewis McKay, they had to tape up her ribs before pushing her on stage. She was too afraid to go to the police, but finally she was brave enough to cut him off. How come I gotta take this from this bitch here? This low-class bitch? McKay raged. If I got a whore, I got some money from her, or I don't have nothing to do with the bitch. I don't want no cunt. He had heard that Harry Anslinger wanted information on her, and he was intrigued. She's been getting away with too much shit, McKay said, adding he wanted Holiday's ass in the gutter in the East River. That, it seems, was the clincher. I got enough to finish her off, he had pledged. I'm gonna do her up so goddamn bad, she gonna remember as long as she live. He traveled to D.C. to see Harry, and he agreed to set her up. When Billy was busted again, she was put on trial. She stood before the court looking pale and stunned. It was called the United States of America versus Billie Holiday, she said. And that's just the way it felt. She refused to weep on the stand. She told the judge she didn't want any sympathy, she just wanted to be sent to a hospital so she could kick the drugs and get well. Please, she said to the judge, I want the cure. She was sentenced instead to a year in a West Virginia prison, where she was forced to go cold turkey and work during the days in a pigsty, among other places. In all her time behind bars, she did not sing a note. Years later, when her autobiography was published, Billy tracked Jimmy Fletcher down and sent him a signed copy. She had written inside it, Most federal agents are nice people. They've got a dirty job to do, and they have to do it. Some of the nicer ones have feelings enough to hate themselves sometime for what they have to do. Maybe they would have been kinder to me if they'd been nasty. Then I wouldn't have trusted them enough to believe what they'd told me. She was right. Jimmy never stopped feeling guilty for what he'd done to Lady Day. Billy paid her debt to society, one of her friends wrote, but society never paid its debt to her. Now, as a former convict, she was stripped of her cabaret performer's license on the grounds that listening to her might harm the morals of the public. This meant she wasn't allowed to sing anywhere that alcohol was served, which included all the jazz clubs in the United States. How do you best act cruelly? Her friend Yolande Bavan asked me in 2013. It's to take something that's the dearest thing to that person away from them. Billy had been able to survive everything. But this...
You despair because you have no control. You can't do the thing that is a passion.